Thank you kindly.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good night.
Bye now. Jeremy calling from Vermont, and yes, we're stuck at about $20 right now. Betsy has her $50 first paycheck challenge on the table. She has put $50 forward, hoping to find 50 more to go with it. We have 20 of the 50. 30 more will make the match, and there's about 55 minutes in which to accomplish that. If you want to hit the PayPal button, it sure would be nice. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I was delighted we got a nice long rain here in Denver last night.
Badly needed, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so that was good to see. We actually had a tornado, too, oddly enough. Kind of not here in Denver, but a little bit south of here.
And those don't happen just a whole bunch out there? Do I understand that correctly?
No, not really. And late September is kind of an odd time of the year for it, usually.
Well, can you imagine how bad it would be if global warming was real?
Oh, yeah. Imagine. I mean, quickly on that issue, the irresponsibility of people like Sean Hannity and, you know, the whole Republican noise machine crew on this critical issue of human security, not just national security, but species security.
You know, that's a great way of looking at it, and that's one of the things that you always bring to the conversations, is that you can take things and move them just a few degrees in one direction or the other, and they make ever so much more sense. If we spent more time, Preston, worrying about species security or human security, we would have probably less national security problems.
Definitely, without a doubt. You know, and I think that's part of the reason why they try so hard to posture as being pro-life, because, again, they're hiding what they really are, truly anti-life in the deepest sense of the term. Yeah, I'm sure everyone has seen the alarming rate at which the Arctic has been melting, and I heard someone say recently, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, and how it's already influencing weather patterns and probably will affect the Gulf Stream and so on and so forth. And yet they persist. You know, a lot of these people who are spreading the propaganda for the fossil fuel industry, they come right out of the tobacco industry. It's some of the same
people.
It's
the same people, and frankly, Preston, it's the same money. It is that whole circle is incestuous, to say the least. But I want to, you know, I want to go back to something you were alluding to just a minute ago, and we will then go forward if you don't mind. But you say these things, and they deserve to be expanded upon because they are important. You know, within the context of global climate catastrophe, the new report that came out, did you see it? It's from a think tank in Spain. Came out a couple of days ago. I think the name of the organization is DAIR. They are estimating that by 2030, which is less than 20 years away, mind you, we could have and may have and probably will have, on a conservative estimate — now, this is not a wild-eyed liberal estimate, this is a conservative estimate — we will have 100 million human deaths on this planet as a result of increased carbon in the atmosphere and climate change itself. They will happen in the poorest nations, but they will also happen in the poorest areas of the richest nations.
Yeah.
And you know, these reports speak to me because, having read what I've read about what's going on in Appalachia and the mounting body of science about that, you know, Larry Gibson's passing brought home to me, while the phrase excess deaths is a statistical phrase, and it is one not readily that does not readily lend itself to personalization, there are 4,000 excess deaths in communities in Appalachia that have mountaintop removal operations in them. because it is the presence of the mountaintop removal operation. Once you've factored for everything else, it is the presence of that mountaintop removal operation in a community that accounts for the 4,000 excess deaths in this state alone. We're not talking about Kentucky. We're not talking about Southwest Virginia. We're not talking about East Tennessee. We're just talking about West Virginia, Preston.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's 4,000, and that's 4,000 funerals that don't have to take place. And yet we are talking about, in 18 years' time, having 100 million funerals.
Yep, and so many communities, like I think it's Louisiana, you know, excess deaths from the chemical and the refinery plants. I think they have a cancer alley there.
Yeah, well, yeah, basically it tracks the Mississippi River, because from Baton Rouge on down, it's just one filthy chemical plant after another, one refinery after another, and all of it. Yeah. Well, you know where the vast majority of the money coming out of those things goes.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Richmond, California, you know, they had that major, I think they had a major explosion not long ago of a Chevron plant.
And they got busted. Brad and Desi were talking about that in tonight's Green News Report.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because they were dummying up systems that were designed to detect and prevent harmful releases of pollutants, and they bypassed them, and the thing blew up.
Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind here in Colorado, near, kind of between Boulder and Denver, we have this place called called Rocky Flats.
Oh, I know about Rocky Flats.
Yeah, building the plutonium triggers for nuclear bombs, and they had about 70,000 of these things. Again, in the name of national security, threatening the security of so many people, lots and lots of cancer deaths for the workers and people around the area. A lady just wrote a book about it called Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. So, again, Orwellian twistings of terms. And all this rhetoric about national security, and the trillions of dollars, and how they define it as more money for the, you know, weapons contractors. How convenient. So all this money goes there, and in communities across this country, we could talk endlessly about these environmental threats. A lot of them connect to the military. By the way, there's a book out called The Green Zone, about how the military is like the number one degrader of the environment, with the defoliation campaigns, the radiation waste, the emissions. I mean, talk about a way we could address climate change quickly and empire. You know, to fuel a aircraft carrier, those things get like half a mile to 30 gallons of gas. And the helicopters hovering around, and the jets, and just all that madness. You know, cut that crap off now. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, fuel needs, they're not fuel needs. These are, it's macho posturing on a military empire scale.
And any parent can tell you the difference between wants and needs. What these are military industrial congressional complex wants. You know, when, for instance, one of my kids said, "Daddy," you know, it was coming on toward Christmas time, "Daddy, I need a PlayStation 3. You know, I looked at them lovingly, and I said, "No, what you're telling me is, Daddy, I want the PlayStation 3. But you cannot convince me that you need it, because it will not contribute to any portion of Maslow's hierarchy of needs." So that opened up a little teachable moment thingy where we talked about food and shelter and clothing. And suddenly I realized, of course, and I say this tangentially, Preston, I realized I had turned into my father, because nothing used to make him crazier than to see me drop a quarter into a Pac-Man machine. Now, this was a child of the Depression, my father. "How can you do that? It won't feed you. It won't keep you warm in the winter. It won't cool you off in the heat of summer. How can you do that?"
Well, sadly, the PlayStation might have some practical career value at some point, you know, if you know, that's part of the career training for some of our current drone pilots.
Well, I was going to say, and this goes way, way back to the days of things like Defender and dropping quarters in those, you know, a million years ago.
When Defender, definitely.
Yeah, you know, I used to ride down to the arcade on my dinosaur.
You know, I was okay at that, but to see someone who was really good at Defender, that was amazing to watch. It was.
And in the paranoid ravings of late teenagers, probably involving vegetable substances, we would look at each other and go, "Dude, do you ever think that these things are like plugged into the government and they're just waiting to see who's really good at this?"
Yeah, recruit this guy. You know, 90,000 points.
Right, and then what? But, just a few years later, you get a movie called The Last Starfighter, in which a kid who's really, really good at one of these space games gets recruited by aliens to go and save the civilization.
Interesting. You know, I know the Pentagon and has been working with colleges like USC to do the development of some of this stuff, and some private Hollywood CGI people have been working on this stuff. In fact, the Army sponsored one, I think, a game called Navy Army of One, something like that.
Yeah, I was about to mention the very thing. And you think that they're not tracking performance on that?
Right, right. And again, I don't want to totally dismiss video games. They can be very interesting in a lot of ways. I think some are very thoughtful.
I was the first, you know, generation to grow up on those things. Interesting. They're time vampires, and they wouldn't succeed unless they were really, really fun.
Yeah. But, you know, be mindful of what game you're playing and, you know, who made it, that kind of thing. Some have progressive storylines to them. Apparently there's one where your goal is to overcome a famine. There's another one where you try to overthrow a dictator and you have to, like, organize street protests and stuff like that. So they're a whole mix. And the military itself, it's not monolithic. There's that military complex. A lot of wickedness.
Well, you know, I had that story toward the end of the program last night, Preston, and it took real heroism on the part of an anonymous member of the military to get in touch with, like, Mikey Weinstein and then the larger for-profit media complex and say, "Listen, these Jesus rifles are still going to our troops, even though the Pentagon told Trijicon to stop making them." And he took a picture of one of the M4 Jesus rifles with the John 8:12 reference on it and sent it along. So, you know, here's a case of the Pentagon saying, "Don't make these things. Don't make it harder for the troops that we're sending over there." And Trijicon and some probably fundamentalist evangelical in the Pentagon procurement division saying, "Screw that. Send them on."
Yep. Amazingly, we even had a defense secretary recently. Gates, is that right?
Yeah, Robert Gates.
Yeah.
The carryover from the Bush administration?
Yeah, I mean, all the right-wing credentials, yet even he made this remark about how bloated the Pentagon budget is. But again, there are these corporate interests that are superseding our government, and they're like, ignore a person like that, ignore a comment like that. If it ever gets out there, try to smear the guy somehow. But yeah, even he was saying this budget is ridiculous. And there are people in the military, energy wise, some want to do this liquefied coal thing, which is what the Nazis were doing actually.
Oh, Jesus, I know.
On the other hand, there are some who are developing fuel from algae, which could be useful.
You know, you mentioned, it could be, and it would not be the first time that military technological developments have had beneficial civilian side effects.
Right, that's so true. The internet, I mean, that came out of DARPA, which is the
digital. You know, digital watches and digital photography are a result of the Apollo and later NASA missions. Now, our national security paranoia kept digital photography from becoming a reality for a lot more years than I'd care to think about. But you mentioned coal to liquid fuel and that whole stinking boondoggle.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Carlin made mention of this. You know, he used to run Buzzflash, and then Buzzflash sort of got folded into Truth Out. Mark is a real good guy. I've met him. I like him. And he says a lot of smart stuff. But he caught something in some Bishop Romney remarks the other day that if they were made by a progressive, by a liberal, by a Democrat, would have the entire for-profit media world on its standing on its own head, lighting its toenails on fire. Okay, I mean, you remember the kerfuffle over the head of the Democratic contingent from California who said that Paul Ryan is a classic manifestation of Goebbels' big lie. Remember that? And you know, of course, the Obama administration immediately threw him under the bus. Well, that's not the kind of dialogue and discourse we want. We can't have them talking about the big lie.
Well, even though they're using it.
Even if they're doing it. Right, yeah. Right. Well, lo and behold, back in May, or back before May, there was some public event where Bishop Romney was speaking. And he was talking about liquefied gas. And this is, and there's a link in this piece to the actual audio, about 42 seconds into the recording. And this boggled my mind because if a progressive said this, everybody from the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, over to Pamela Geller, to the, you know, the whole filthy Breitbart crowd, and ABC, NBC, CBS, and you know, MSNBC would have to denounce them. I mean, you know how the drill works, right, Preston?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what the bishop says. Liquefied gas. Gosh. Hitler during the Second War, I guess, because he was concerned about losing his oil, liquefied coal. That technology's still there. I'm told the Chinese are building 5 liquefied coal plants right now. Bishop Willard Romney mentioned Adolf Hitler in a positive fashion, and I guess the crowd just clapped.
Interesting. Wow.
But yeah, it is true that the coal liquefaction as a fuel is a technology that was developed by German scientists at the behest of Adolf Hitler as a substitute for petroleum, because Germany has a hydrocarbon fuel problem.
Mm-hmm. And we should keep in mind, speaking of the big lie in Goebbels, you know, they learned a lot of their techniques from an American guy named Edward Bernays.
Yes, Edward Bernays came up on the program last night.
Mm-hmm. A nephew of Sigmund Freud.
Precisely.
He also worked for...
Wasn't he kind of the father of public relations?
Exactly. He wrote a book called Propaganda. You know, literally wrote the book on the topic. And he worked for the government at times when they did he worked for United Fruit during the whole coup against...
Oh, you mean the United Fruit that Smedley Butler based war as a racket on...
There you go. Exactly. Bernays also worked for the cigarette company. I should distinguish between tobacco and cigarette industry. You know, I think tobacco kind of organically, I don't know, it might have some utilities. But boy, and I know you're a smoker, and I'm sure.
No, I am, and I'm the first, and I'm the first one who will note, because I, oh golly, do I love a good cigar. I just don't get them. But
you know, cigarettes used to be smoked. I learned this recently, a book called The Golden Holocaust. Cigarettes used to be smoked like cigars. They weren't inhaled, but they've figured out a new way to cure it, and they also added a lot of stuff.
Well, that's what I was about to say, Preston. What goes into a standard cigarette is tobacco, the way what's in a McDonald's hamburger is beef. It's been processed beyond recognition.
Yeah.
You know what the way that they are able to manipulate the nicotine content and manipulate your addiction with a cigarette is because they take the tobacco, they grind it up, they add a bunch of crap to it, and they basically turn it into it's like a paper, as I understand it, and then they re-shred it. I mean, if you're a cigarette smoker and you get a pouch of what's it called, Natural American Spirit,
mm-hmm.
which is real tobacco that's been, and you roll your own, the taste difference and the addiction response is wildly different.
I bet.
By extension, most good cigars. Now, I'm not talking about blunts and the floor sweepings of a White Owl or something like that. But a real cigar that has been grown semi-organically is, you know, tobacco is bunched, a binder is wrapped around it, and then the one thing that changes the flavor the most is the wrapper. And great lengths are pursued to make the wrapper behave differently based upon what you want out of the cigar. You can sit there and smoke a cigar a day, two cigars. You can smoke a half a box a day. But the thing is, you're not going to get up the next morning and the first thing you do is light a cigar, because it is not going, the addiction process is entirely different.
Yeah, yeah. And plus, you know, the cigarette companies recently have been actually spiking the nicotine levels to increase the addiction level.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's all kinds of little manipulations. For instance, when taxes were added on, they responded by making a cheaper cigarette that burns faster, and these so-called fire prevention cigarettes that go out if you don't sit there and honk on them. Those aren't fire prevention cigarettes. Those are smoke more of them faster cigarettes. Under the guise of making sure that you don't fall, you know, that you don't burn yourself up in your sleep by, you know, because you smoke in bed.
Yeah.
You know, I have never, with the possible exception of Winston Churchill, heard of anybody smoking a Havana in bed. He liked to. He had a snifter of brandy brought to him in the morning, and he'd sit there and honk up a cigar, and sit there and work on it all day. But that's a totally different story. The third volume, by the way, of the Winston Churchill biography that was started by William Manchester and then he died, has been finished by his hand-picked successor, and I'm kind of looking forward to reading that because it covers the Second World War years. But no, smoking and tobacco and cigarettes are things that have to be considered separately. I mean, my God, how I wish I could just sit, because I was gifted with some. If I could just sit and torch up a Cuban cigar every evening during the show, oh, it'd be lovely. It would just be wonderful.
Well, hopefully we'll take down that blockade on Cuba, and we can get into some fair trade.
Yeah, but you know what scares me out of that, Preston, is you know what's going to happen when the blockade comes down. The blockade will come down only when Cuba concedes that it is willing to be recorporatized by the United States of America.
To be overrun by McDonald's and all that stuff.
Well, and by Altria Philip Morris and by RJR, you know, and Cuban cigars will be forever ruined.
Yeah, yeah, there's a real possibility for that. On the other hand, you know, I'm a possibilitarian.
Oh, I love that.
For positive possibilities, to, you know, having free and fair trade that isn't, you know, perverted, and, you know, I think it can happen. I see it happening here and there. There are some interesting fair trade. Coffee is a good example. Certainly there's a mountain of coffee that gets traded out of circumstances of hyper-exploited labor, heavy pesticide use, forest devastation. But there's a segment around the world, international, that's fair, organic.
And I do my best to buy that when at all possible. We've got a lovely little local restaurant across the river here called the Cathedral Cafe, and they serve and sell equal exchange fair trade coffee. And Agnes loves their organic mind, body, and soul. So I will when I can afford it, go, because you know, it winds up being. It's probably a third to maybe a half more expensive than what you get at Wally World, but it doesn't come with the hate and the cruelty.
Right. And they can grow the coffee plant or bush. Are they trees? I don't know. But anyway, they can grow them in a way that welcomes birds. It doesn't destroy their habitat. It invites them in. Shade-grown coffee, I think they call it. And so many things like that can go in, either direction. It's like, who's controlling it? You know, what's the agenda?
And if you've got informed consumers, I think most people would rather have something that has not been exploitative and loaded with extra brutality along with the high fructose corn syrup. But the infrastructure thing that we have to work toward building is being able to let people know that. I mean, I think the heart and soul of the future of what you're discussing there, Preston, is what's going on with Prop 37 in California now.
I was just going to bring that up.
Andy updated me the other day on the buku millions of dollars that are being pumped into this, because the GMO industry knows that people, I mean, they've done their own focus group work.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that people will choose foods that aren't GMOs. And, you know, if you do that, then there goes the Roundup Ready corn.
Yep. And they're losing. That's a good example. Again, positive possibilities. Monsanto is losing some markets. I saw Russia recently has decided to put a moratorium. There's some recent study released that shows.
Out of France that shows that it's cancer-inducing.
Yep. And other countries, including some in the global south, have rejected it entirely. You know, Monsanto keeps coming at them, but...
And that was the beautiful thing, you know, that was the beautiful thing about being across the pond in the EU, in Germany. You know, it is so, I was taken to the grocery store. That's where I became fascinated with the all-wheel steering buggies. I'm a very simple person. All four wheels on the buggies in the grocery store all turn, so you can go sideways down the aisle if you want to. But they've got organic over there, but then they've got no really, really not kidding organic. You know, ultra, super, duper, hyper organic. And that's what the folks I was with loved to buy. And to drink the milk, oh, my God. I mean, it was like the cow was handing it to you. It was so good.
I'm trying to think of that word that kind of describes that super organic. It's like bio something.
The labeling on this was just B-O-B-O, B-I-O-B-I-O.
Oh, okay. Okay, interesting. There's a wine that I drink every once in a while that's like super organic, bio something. It'll come to me later, but... Anyway, I was reading in Yes Magazine. They had an article recently, something like Soccer Moms Take on Monsanto, or California's Soccer Moms Take on Monsanto. And Monsanto, they've got the millions of dollars, but we've got, you know, the grassroots. You know, that's how they're going to get publicity. It's not, they don't have the budget, but, you know, we can talk about it on shows like this. And, Facebook, they need help with their own publicity campaign, and hopefully they can get beat back.
Indeed, indeed.
And real quickly on the coffee issue, there's a documentary people might want to check out called Black Gold, and it kind of follows the visits coffee growers in Ethiopia, and there's a union of coffee growers, and there's a guy who travels around the world, goes to a lot of Starbucks and challenges them on their coffee. I mean, they're making, again, they're pulling in so much money.
Well, I kind of despise Starbucks, and this is a very selfish position of mine, Preston. I despise Starbucks because it sucks. It doesn't taste good. I learned a little bit about the history of Starbucks, that it was apparently it was a bunch of cast-off, overrun, overburnt, over-roasted beans, and some wise guy said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to sell this to the rubes and tell them it's really special.
Well, I know a lot of people enjoy it, and...
I'll say this much. Decaf, since I'm a decaffeinated guy, decaf is kind of hard to come by in good form, even when you're making it in your own home. So I do buy the Starbucks instant stuff so that I can at least have one instead of having a cup of hot brown water that tastes like melted Crayola. So, I'm guilty as charged. I try to put my hypocrisies out front so everybody can know what they are.
But I know what you mean. But, you know, every now and again, but I try to go to independent stores. I don't drink a lot of coffee, but when I do.
Well, it's like this little Cathedral Cafe across the river from me. If we're over there, you know, we'll you know, I'll look at Agnes and say, you want a cup of coffee? And she'll say, sure. And that's where we go. If they built a Starbucks across the street from Cathedral Cafe, I'd be going into Cathedral Cafe because I know that what they do is equal exchange and fair trade. And I know that I'm supporting a local business that's owned by people I really, really like, that employs local people. And, you know, they got good food and good coffee and good tea, and it's just a nice experience, and I don't think anybody's getting abused in the process.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Before I let you go, I also want to mention, you know, public radio, it certainly has its own issues. Biodynamic. It's going to bug me if I didn't remember that. Yeah, but
I love how that works.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, our public radio recently, they're not real great on Iran. They're not as belligerent as the right wing's talk radio for sure, but they're not real good. It's hard to get a word in edgewise about the history of U.S.-Iranian relations and overthrows and, you know, simply the fact that we've got that country surrounded by, like, 40 military bases.
Yeah.
And so for us to posture as the ones threatened, it's
quite an
achievement.
I still maintain, Preston, that there are people out there who do know history. And I'm such a nerd. I was wandering around through Polybius the other day and ran back across the origins and prosecution of the Third Punic War. And anybody who wants to understand why we behaved the way we did toward Iraq, why we are behaving the way we are behaving toward Iran, need go no further than Polybius and read the story of Aemilianus, who was the general in the Third Punic War, and read the story of Cato the Elder and his Delenda Carthago Est, constant drumbeat for the destruction of Carthage, and you find out about how the Rome. I mean, and that moment, the 146 BC, I think it was BCE, was the moment in which Rome lost its soul.
Yeah.
And every rotten thing that happened to Rome flowed from that, out of that moment, and you know, it should serve. You know, that's what I was trying to say about Jeremy, about understanding that this is empire now. And that empires behave in a certain fashion, and you oppose imperial behavior with different tactics. If you go back and you read this, you can see there, and what followed with Tiberius Gracchus, for instance, is very much mirrored in the tragic story of John Kennedy. You can see all of this.
Yep.
And you know that there are people out there who know this stuff and who are either intentionally or unintentionally mirroring it. I just got an email in from our buddy Andy, who said your conversation with Preston, Cuba, and he said, don't forget, Bob, the Bush family will have to be given back their sugar plantations in Cuba, the Bacardis, their rum distilleries, the DuPonts, their manufacturing plants, the Harrimans, their banks, and all the other top 1% scumbag oppressors will demand their property back from the Cuban state in whole.
Yeah.
Once the great families get their great wealth back, then Cuba can have the WTO free trade status that China now possesses. I'm sure the great families are salivating to get hold of that cheap labor.
Mm, well put. Definitely. You know, and there again, an issue. Cuba, if they talk about the leadership, they'll say, oh, that terrible dictator, Fidel Castro, dictator. Batista, anybody? You know, the guy?
Yeah, we kind of forgot.
All those years?
Yeah, but as the saying goes, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Hey, Preston,
right.
I've got a roll, my friend. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Okay. I'm sorry, Bob. I've got to make this one last comment.
Okay, sure.
Just real quickly, NPR problems, Fresh Air last week, they had a episode. They interviewed the author of a book called The Myth of the Muslim Tide.
I heard that interview,
okay.
And I've got to read that book. It was brilliant.
Excellent.
And anybody who can go and hear that conversation needs to hear it.
A total takedown of the bigotry that helps to advance the agenda of, you know, the people who are still living the Roman Empire stuff. they're always going to have their rationales and their fancy philosophies to say, oh, we got to do it to
them. Right, and the heart and soul of that is that, you know, these animals breed like rats and they're going to overrun us.
Yep. So myth of the Muslim tide.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up because I was completely mesmerized by the conversation.
I'm going to post it to your Facebook page.
Oh, please do. And don't forget to post it to the Horn page as well, Preston.
The Horn page. I'll do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Bye now. The Horn's resident optimist. That's Preston. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
No, listen, that... I didn't know what. My head exploded when I saw that idiot with the...
With his bomb picture?
The cartoon bomb. Yeah, that was... I mean, I didn't mean to... I guess I shouldn't be laughing, but it was just ridiculous.
It is.
And you listen? I mean, in his horrible, I'm so important tone, holding that dumbass picture, talking about... Something at 90, 70, 90. I mean, the fool was saying at 92. I mean, he's completely, there's no credibility there. He's just a warmonger, and he's taken so seriously by this country. It's scary.
But, I agree with everything you say, Sandra. So let's go back to what I mentioned earlier, the cui bono aspect. Who's going to get rich out of this? I mean, is it the oil companies because the price of oil will spike through the roof?
Well, there's that, but that's not going to do anything for the, developed nations. They're going to, it's going to cause...
No, and it's not going to do anything for Israeli security either, because as much as we like to promote the idea that there's this intractable divide between Shia and Sunni and Sufi and whatever, the fact of the matter is when they see the West off on at the connivance of Israel, I might add, off on another crusade, probably with our Jesus rifles, they're going to band together. You know, there are a lot of people in Iran who would like to have a greater ability to express themselves via personal freedoms. They are suddenly going to become the most devout adherents of the dictatorial so-called regime over there that there are. There is no net positive that comes out of this any way you slice it.
Well, which is why Obama is not, is resisting completely because, whatever you want to say about him, he's not a complete lunatic. So he knows that it's not in our interest to, begin a fifth, fourth, sixth front on in the Muslim world. I mean, see, and Israel, they don't want to do it alone. I think that's a lot to do with it. It's a lot of bluster on Netanyahu, but he really needs the...
But for once, Israel needs to grow up, and they have to, if they're going to do this, they need to know that they're going to do it alone.
Well, no, but that's the problem. He's not, that's what all the pressure is about. And the funny thing about it, if there is any comedy to it, is, Netanyahu is backing himself in a corner because do you think Obama's going to be smiling at his face when he gets reelected? I think that's one relationship that will probably suffer a fair amount.
Well, I mean, look, those ads that you know that we talked about, the ones that ran in Florida with him talking about his red line again, Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah, I'm sure the Obama administration ain't appreciating none of it. And yeah. I think that he's taking a risk because, Obama is going to go Bush 1 on him. Not Bush 2, Bush 1. And Bush 1 is not very liked in Israel, if you remember. He was one of the only presidents in recent times to, sort of say no to Israel. And I think that, there's a good chance that Obama could take that track. Remember that little slip accidentally on purpose? Oh, at least you don't have to deal with him all the time like I do. Remember that,
yep.
That little conversation?
Yep.
That's why I say accidentally on purpose, because none of this shit is a coincidence.
Well, and the thing is, after those ads ran in Florida for an obvious and direct effect, that was a political ad if ever there was one. If Barack Obama is reelected, Sandra, what's the likelihood of Benjamin Netanyahu getting invited to dinner anytime soon? I mean, he'll be relegated down to a liberal media blogger, beans and Kool-Aid and styrofoam cup status, won't he?
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, who knows, really? But, I mean, the possibilities are more towards a further cooling off than us going to war against Iran. That's all I'm saying. So, you know, that's why you have this, you know, sort of kind of desperate, because that fool was there with that diagram at the U.N. I'm thinking, well, it's not like you're going to get a warm reception from the General Assembly, as we know, because they don't give a – they're not interested in Israel. In fact, a lot of them countries despise Israel. So, you know, it was like you said, crazy with Ahmadinejad and crazy with this fool.
And that's – but that, the sad thing is that's not a good recipe for the rest of the world.
No, all of it's really horrible. Like I said, you know, the people who will make money, I guess, are the same speculative financialization that's, you know, wrecking the world economy anyway. I don't know. He's such a really odious character, actually, Netanyahu. Wow. It's stunning.
Well, I wonder if this could bring him, you know, bring him down within the territorial confines of his own country. And the, you know, the larger question too is, do you think? I mean, I look at him and I see in him the same degree of crazy that I see in Ahmadinejad. Do you think he really believes this bullshit that he got up on the podium and spewed?
Well, did Colin Powell believe it?
Well, see, I don't think Colin Powell did believe it.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I just think that, you know, I don't know. I think if he's just some sort of, because he seems so desperate to have a military engagement, I don't know. I just find the whole, you know, Israel, their whole act is getting so tired in Israel with their, you know, sort of 19th century behavior with the colonialism, the whole nine yards. It's such a detestable state at this point. I'm sorry. They really are kind of the new South Africa at this point.
Well, they are, and it's largely the fault of the Likud party, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if you read the Israeli press, there are more liberal and progressive voices, and, you know, the people who pour out into the streets who just want to live, they don't seem to manifest that same hard line weirdness.
Yeah, no. Oh, no, there seems to be, obviously, there's a lot of discontent economically in Israel because, you know, we have another economy that's not working for everyone. Surprise, surprise. And
yeah.
So there's a lot of unrest in that regard. But anyway, I don't know. It was more the aesthetics that had me going with that one. I'm like, wow, you know, dude.
Well, that's why I ran straight to Operation Rabbit and the, I am obviously more intelligent than you.
No, that's a funny clip when he just slams the door.
We sent you people a check last week.
Isn't that just what you want to do? I mean, that is so apt for all these crazies these days. And the fact that it's more apt now. When was that cartoon made?
1952.
I mean, what the hell? I'm just thinking, oh my God. Anyway, so yeah, that's BB. And you know, unfortunately, I was looking at Netanyahu's Twitter feed, and you should have seen all the people. Yes, you know. So no, you know, we are sort of, I don't know how many people looked at that and thought, oh my God, crazy train, but there's a lot of people who are like, yes, you know.
Well, because there's a whole lot of people in this country who will say yes to Bibi Netanyahu, and as soon as they get done typing on their little Twitter feed, they'll say, yes, come Lord Jesus.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, of course you have to go there, but what I was trying to say is that it's easy to get caught up in our little information silo, but, you know, but I do think that, you know, I think a lot of people, got a bit of a chuckle from that, because I certainly read some funny-ass responses to that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just ridiculous, because it just looked crazy. It looked crazy. It was a bomb.
Like with his red crayon.
Yeah, with the cartoon sort of, I don't know. It's too bad that there's really no way of, hopefully, listeners can just go and look at it, because it's all over the place.
But I wish I had the video editing skills talent, because I would take that Wile E. Coyote clip and I would superimpose it over the audio of Netanyahu.
Yeah,
permit me to introduce myself. Wile E. Coyote. Genius. And I think it would go viral.
No, it'd be perfect. But, I mean, I didn't really want to, I just wanted to connect with that because that was the fun, you know, that was so damn funny when that all went down on the Twitter.
Oh, I was so glad when I saw that because I had the story about the woman stomping the crap out of the cleric in Iran. And that was a perfect counterpoint to it.
Yeah, well, that story is like, damn. That woman must have been channeling just zillions of women from around the world on that one.
From 1,400 years worth of oppression.
That's what I mean, you know. And the fact that idiot still thinks that, you know, oh, I still must carry on. Keep on doing it, fool, until someone smashes your head and you won't be able to do nothing again. But anyway, listen, what was more funnier than that the whitest man on earth coming out apologizing to fans and getting them refs sorted out quickly?
Oh, that, like I said, candy and chocolates. You know, are you talking about Steve Young?
No. I was talking about Roger Goodell.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they surely wrapped that up. All of a sudden, they got a deal. It's interesting.
Yeah, but it's not the best deal in the world. I read some details on it. The refs still lost their pension.
Oh, they did. Yeah, no, I haven't had a chance to see it. I mean,
the refs keep their pension. Existing refs now keep their pension until 2016. After that, it rolls over into a 401k, and all refs hired from now on are in a 401k. So they've been compelled to go and play with the tender mercies of Wall Street.
That two-tier shit.
Yeah, and I hate it. I hate it when labor organizations do that, Sandra, because they're, you know, what they're doing is, and I understand protecting your present benefits, but you ought not be allowed to F the future members of your organization.
Well, no, because it's just weakening your, you know, your organization is going to be not very viable, you know, in the next crop. I mean, it's terrible. I felt sick when that Goodell was on TV talking about, well, you know, I don't have a pension and only 10% of Americans do, and like that son of a bitch makes $20 million a year. He don't need a pension. I mean, it's so obnoxious.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible that he would sit up there and say that as if.
And you know, we pretend that we see the dangers that players themselves are exposed to, and I guess we kind of forget how daggum dangerous. You know, the refs ain't got the pads. I mean, you ever see one of the refs get just slobber knocked by one of these? Incredibly, you know, hyper athletic the players. I mean, they get knocked for a loop.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, I'll go and read and see if I can find out more about their deal. Anyway, but just, you know, they're just 32 nasty people who think that no one's going to tell them what to do, no matter what. You know, it has that air about it. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen, I got to go. So.
All right. Have yourself a good evening, Sandra. Thanks,
right.
And thanks for the photo. You made the show.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. That's Sandra. Really, anybody, video skills? Take that. The name of the cartoon is Operation Rabbit. Take the video of Ahmadinejad talking and superimpose. Permit me to introduce myself. My name is Wile E. Coyote. Genius. Just it'll be really funny. Trust me. A little reminder before we go to probably our last call of the evening. We are at 30. We're almost there. $20 to go to meet Texas Betsy's. Hey, I got my first paycheck challenge this evening. $20 to go, and it sure would be great. Onward. I hope. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Buzz. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. What's up, Jim?
You?
I'm trying.
I hear you. Number one, my congratulations to Texas Betsy and her newly acquired position and paycheck. That's always good.
Hear, hear. And congratulations to the lucky students that get to be taught by her.
Well, having spent so many years in the classroom before going into my other career, I wish her all the best because it's definitely a very daunting challenge.
It is hard work.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And you're not going to like me for saying this, but I got to say it anyway. As far as the NFL and all this kind of stuff are concerned, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're overpaid, oversexed, over whatever, and they're over here.
I understand that, but I'm not talking about this as a, you know, from a sporting standpoint. I'm talking about it from
that.
A labor standpoint.
I understand.
And
that.
It's once again, it's a case of millionaires trying to screw working people out of, you know, pensions are deferred compensation. It's money that you put away for your future. And here
that.
They are trying to screw them out of that and force them into the tender mercies of the market, and I find that infuriating, Jim.
Well, I can understand your position. I certainly do. And the last thing I have to say is, it is such a pity that all the things that we enjoy are either immoral, illegal, ill whatever it is, and hazardous to your health.
Lord, ain't it? But I guess none of them would be any fun if they weren't, would they?
Well, I can remember when you used to enthuse about making chili and all this kinds of stuff, and then going to the cooker and the other. And those were times that I'll remember as being some of the most enjoyable elements of your program.
And I still love to do it. I wish, you know, the chili cook-off is coming up soon in Beckley, and I wish I could be participating, but. Yeah.
Well, you know, Bob, last thing here, it's like the preface to the Alice B. Toklas cookbook. Remember what she wrote?
Tell us.
About a body not being able to enjoy repast of former times.
Indeed. Indeed.
Very victim.
And be well, and we will talk soon, I hope.
I hope so. And you take care. And be careful, Bob.
Trying to.
Good night.
Later, Jim. Our good buddy Jim closing out the evening this Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. First and foremost, you with your kind contributions that are the only reason the horn remains on the air. Thanks for your ideas, your phone calls, your emails, your participation in the chat room. We've had a rousing little discussion going in the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room this evening. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy, and thank you for the challenge this evening. Hopefully we will meet it before night's end. Thanks to John Fox down in Australia for all he does to keep everything rolling here. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks, of course, always go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AcheAct.org. Go there and learn how you can help end Appalachia's agony, AcheAct.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.
Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop renewable. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bayard, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! another week is in the history books. Here it is, the 28th day of September, 2012, and when we meet again, when next we meet again, it will be October. I want to start the program out by thanking you all for helping us meet our fundraising goals for the month of September. That's huge in order for us to have an October. And thus, we will begin October's fundraising soon. Well, we've already begun it because you decided to begin it. We are still $20 away from meeting Texas Betsy's new job challenge. So if anybody wants to kick that in this evening, that would be wonderful. And probably, there's been, by the way, some issues. I had a note from Ben Birch over at White Rose Society. He's had some software issues that have messed up his recordings of the program, and that's why the podcasts have been a little bit squirrely, but he says that will be getting sorted out post-haste. Your patience is appreciated. It's Friday on the front porch here at the Horn. It's been raining all day long here in the hills and hollers of almost level West By God, Virginia. Of course, that's to be expected from time to time because this is a temperate rainforest. Or it was before the coal companies began blasting away 500 or so mountains with plans to blast more. Yeah. And, of course, that involves the deforestation of the this huge temperate rainforest. But it is. It's been rainy and kind of gray all day long. But that's all right. There are lots of places in this country that would love to have that rain. You know? It is Friday on the front porch. That means we will engage in a little, I don't know, maybe a little more lighthearted, a little bit more easygoing conversation. Or not. Things can change. I mean, for instance, I got this email from Dr. John earlier asking, haven't these folks ever heard of the Mama Rule? You know what the Mama Rule is. It's a rule that says you don't say nothing about Mama. It is held to be sacrosanct, especially in the South. Dr. John also noting with regard to this story, man, the biracial thing just eats them alive, don't it? And it does. It does. The story in particular is of the latest sleazing of President Barack Obama. And the rule, the Mama Rule, apparently does not apply to this president. Amanda Marcotte, writing at Slate, in a story headlined, Conservatives Stoop to Slut-Shaming Obama's Dead Mother. Well, first, what was it, 2009, when the Republican Party's candidate for president, when his church dead-baptized the poor woman, who had just suffered through a terrible, trying bout of cancer. She wasn't long in the dirt before the Mormons dead baptized her. Amanda Marcotte writing, frustrated Obama obsessives, unable to believe that the rest of the country doesn't share their paranoid suspicion that the president has dark secrets lurking under his amiable exterior, have finally stooped to slurring his mother through the time-honored method of calling her a slut. And the story is about a new, what Amanda Marcotte refers to as a new round of rumor mongering about Obama's origins, in which it is now claimed that Barack Obama's father was not Barack Obama's father because Barack Obama's mother was sleeping all over the place. Refers to a BS documentary called Dreams from My Real Father. See, isn't that clever, the play on the word, the title of the Obama book? Yeah, that documentary is being mailed around to voters in so-called swing states. Amanda Marcotte says, Dreams from My Real Father peddles a conspiracy theory so convoluted that more traditional birthers must be envious of its creativity. The director, Joel Gilbert, argues that Obama's real father is Frank Marshall Davis, a labor activist and poet, and that Davis took bondage photos of Obama's mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, that he then sold to nudie magazines. Naturally, these questionable photos are prominently displayed in the documentary, and a short clip from the movie with the photos is available for embedding on every 2-bit birther blog on the Internet. Gilbert claims to have mailed out 1 million copies to voters in Ohio, and in this post-Citizens United era, it's quite possible he does have anonymous donors who made that kind of mail push possible. The other player in this sleazy act is of no surprise to you or me, Dinesh D'Souza. He accuses Stanley Ann Dunham of neglecting her son so she could sleep around Indonesia, painting her as a sexual predator and pretending to be amazed that she supposedly got it on so often despite being a heavy woman.
Huh? What, Edith?
You would hope that the American people who receive such a thing would actually hold that family values candidate, Bishop Willard Romney, to account for it. That they would recognize the violation of the mama rule. Don't talk about mama. But I don't know about this country anymore. I don't know. Because the biracial thing, as Dr. John notes, really does drive these white conservative antediluvian goobers around the bend. Reminds me of that video that was produced for Bill Maher's program where the journalist went to Mississippi and found, of course, someone went, I don't like him because he's a half-breed. Oh, yuck. Just yuck. Dr. John says he's calling it Empty Glass Friday. Well, that's what happens after you come up on the front porch and you pour a little jigger or so out of that crockery jug with the corn cob stopper. Or maybe you just have a glass of lemonade or sweet iced tea. This is it's unconscionable. These right-wingers who claim to be imbued with such finely developed morals because they're in the church every time they unlock the doors. Never mind the question of why the church needs to keep the doors locked. Go past that. Jim asking the question, remember McCain's black love child? Yeah, they sleazed him with, the Bush people sleazed John McCain with that in South Carolina. Never mind that the child had been adopted. Never mind that it was a manifest good. the robocalls went all over that state during in 2000. Did you know that John McCain has a Negro daughter? We got race mixing in among the candidates. At least George Bush's daughters, even though they might have been conceived in a test tube, at least they were conceived white. Yeah, I remember that, Jim. Thanks for the reminder. What else is there out there today? There's some stuff that I've been wanting to make sure that we got to because it is a representation of American reality that gets mighty short shrift. An interesting development in Phoenix, Arizona, of late. The mayor of Phoenix, Greg Stanton, accepted a challenge to live on a food stamp budget for a week as his observation of Hunger Awareness Month. He kept a diary on the challenge. It allotted him roughly $29 a week. That's the same amount that 1.1 million people in Arizona get from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, every week. $29. Don't spend it all in one place, and eat hearty, me mateys. On day four, Greg Stanton's diary entry read like this. Okay, ran out the door today with no time to scramble eggs or even make a sandwich. So I'm surviving on an apple and handful of peanuts and the coffee I took to the office until dinner. I'm tired, and it's hard to focus. I can't go buy a sandwich because that would be cheating. Even the dollar menu at Taco Bell is cheating. You can't use SNAP benefits at any restaurants, fast food or otherwise. I'm facing a long, hungry day and even longer night getting dinner on the table, which requires making everything from scratch on this budget. It's only for a week, so I've got a decent attitude. If I were doing this with no end in sight, I probably wouldn't be so pleasant. And there are questions inside this story. One, Republican or Democrat, I don't know, but I respect Mayor Stanton for at least giving it a try. There's nothing like a walk in someone else's shoes to give you an appreciation for how tired feet can get at the end of a day. $29 a week for food? That's barbaric. It is just slightly less barbaric than not doing it at all. But the fiscal family values Republicans in the House are offended by it. This is one of those situations that they describe by saying, we have created a culture of government dependency in this country, and people have lost their liberty. Well, how free are you if you're starving? Of course, these ignorant trolls also don't understand that the origins of the food supplement program were not altruistically aimed toward feeding poor people, but were instead aimed at creating a welfare program for farmers to buy excess produce, which the government then had to unload somewhere, and, well, you might as well let the poor people eat it. Such were the origins of that magnificent cheese. And darn good peanut butter. Of flour and rice and beans. But then the capitalists realized that they were missing out on some of the fun, so the food stamp program was created, in which people could actually go to retailers and buy what they wanted, at, of course, inflated retail prices. But that was no good, because sometimes the poor people were given cash back in change, and you know what they do with that cash? Why, they just go out there and they buy themselves some alcohol or some beer or liquor or maybe some thunderbolt lightning wine. And you can't have poor people doing that. They're not responsible enough to get liquored up like us well-heeled people do. Probably ain't even ashamed to go in the liquor store like a deacon is. $29 a week. I go to the grocery store periodically. $29 doesn't buy much. If you live on staples, bread, eggs, beans, rice, it still doesn't go very far. Coffee is very expensive. We talked a little bit about coffee last night in our conversation with Preston. But that's the reality of hunger. Our idea of alleviating hunger is to provide people $29 a week on which to eat. Why isn't it 50? Why not at least $10 a day? 70. Well, the answer to that's fairly simple. Because in this country, we have good, upstanding, God-fearing Republicans who, one supposes, think that hunger is somehow beneficial to the soul. Yeah, maybe they'll spend a little more time praying instead of eating. Live on hay day by day. There'll be pie in the sky when you die. That's for that's that $29 a day. That's children, elderly, working people, the working poor. Dr. John noting, Mayor Stanton lost 4 pounds that week. A nice one-week fitness regimen, Dr. John observes. Of course, how long can you lose 4 pounds a week and, well, you know, survive? I thought I said he was the mayor of Phoenix. Maybe I did say Tucson. He's a Democrat. Wikipedia notes he is a former Phoenix City Council member who represented areas of North Phoenix